This is New Beginnings, hosted by award-winning broadcaster and speaker Freddie Bell. A program for and about America's 78 million baby boomers. Here's your host, Freddie Bell.
Hi, everyone. This is New Beginnings. I am Freddie Bell. Glad you're with us today. And coming up on the show, many of our favorite partners, including Leibel Sternbach is here, Joe McKenzie, and friends from AARP Minnesota. All this plus the words to the wise on New Beginnings. And our program is underway right now. Joining us right now is Dr. Michael Osterholm, epidemiologist and a professor at the University of Minnesota, who is a vice president. And doctor, we're getting reports now that COVID deaths are going down in cases as well. Can you talk about that?
The latest numbers from WHO, if you look in the 28-day period leading up to June 4th, in other words, May 8th to June 4th, there were a total of 1.7 million cases and 10,000 deaths reported worldwide. Now, again, I have to come back and qualify. The case numbers are at best wild, wild guesstimates. We know that we are having major underreporting of the number of cases in our communities. In terms of deaths, they too are underreported, but are a more reliable indication, I think, of what's happening with the pandemic. So in terms of official numbers, you can clearly see the downward trend continue, which matches with what we've been seeing throughout the first half of 2023. That said, even if you focus in a bit more and look at the regional data, you'll find that all six WHO regions actually documented declines for both cases and deaths in the latest 28-day span. Again, with the caveat that I just shared that these are official numbers and there are major gaps in reporting, you can see that compared to the previous 28-day period, deaths declined 78% in the Eastern Mediterranean region, 54% in Europe, 44% in the Americas, and 35% in Southeast Asia. Finally, the Western Pacific region reported a 19% decrease in deaths, and Africa reported a 17% decline. So even on a regional basis, there's some real consistency with these declines. Now, with that being said, there are certain countries going against the trend. One that we've kept an eye on a fair bit is China. And although official data from the country is sparse, their CDC released data this past weekend indicating that the test positivity rate in Chinese hospitals stood at around 40% by the end of May, representing a fivefold increase compared to the previous month. So this has basically confirmed the anecdotal but growing accounts of another surge in China. And to me, it's another asterisk that could be added to the official WHO numbers I just got done sharing. In fact, shifting to the U.S., the latest variant data from the CDC signals that the XBB variant family, which is comprised of 10 different circulating versions, currently accounts for around 99.9% of all cases in this country. So again, the situation in China, at least in terms of variants, is not unique. With that said, the situation in the U.S. when it comes to activity does appear to be a bit different than China. In this country overall, we're basically seeing continued declines through 2023. Beginning in May, we saw the number of Americans hospitalized with COVID hit a new all-time low, falling below the levels reached during the previous lull in April 2022. And since that milestone, we've continued to drop to even further lows. In fact, as of June 3rd, there were 6,600 Americans hospitalized with the virus. No doubt that's welcome news, and I surely hope it continues. However, it would be helpful to know what impact the reduction in hospital screening and pre-admission testing for COVID is having on these numbers. Regardless, it is also reassuring to see that COVID deaths in this country have consistently declined through 2023 and are at the lowest levels reported since the start of the pandemic. Still, we must not forget that these deaths still are our brothers and our sisters, our mothers, our fathers, our grandparents, and this is still something that is a real challenge to addressing.
Doctor, talk about the individual risk factors for COVID.
Remember, this was not really a pandemic. This was a wave of pandemic activity that changed dramatically from the first year to the second year to the third year. And interpreting what worked or what happened in any of those years could be very different than the previous year or the year after. And so, from that perspective, let me just give you some examples. If you look at the issue with lockdowns, we have had many people do analyses on did lockdowns make a difference or not. Well, first of all, I don't even know what a lockdown is really, because there's no one standard definition for it. But if you look at what happened with stay-at-home orders, which is one of the categories used in this modeling study, did the government in that state put forward a stay-at-home order? And Minnesota was a classic example. We did that. And our governor issued that in March of 2020. But what was challenging was, as much as we had a quote-unquote stay-at-home order or lockdown, they then reviewed who was considered an essential employee. Ultimately, 82% of the Minnesota workforce was deemed an essential employee. That's hardly a lockdown. And yet that's what it's called in the analysis. If you look at another example, pediatric cases, I think this has been an example of this at the extreme. Early in the pandemic, there was little evidence that, in fact, we were seeing any kind of major transmission or severe illnesses among those in the pediatric population. And as such, then became the norm that, in fact, this was not a problem. But that's not true. A way to consider this changing risk over time is just to examine deaths due to COVID in children 17 and younger in the U.S. In the first 3 years of the pandemic, there were 1,486 deaths recorded in this age group, 199 in 2020, 609 in 2021, and 678 in 2022. 87% of the deaths in children 17 and younger occurred in the second 2 years of the pandemic. Well, what happened? Well, public health officials, educators, and researchers greatly underestimated the evolving risk of infection with the eventual arrival of variants like Alpha, Delta, and Omicron over the next 2 years. These variants were increasingly more infectious in kids and caused much more severe clinical illness. Most regions of the country saw increasingly larger surges of pediatric cases in May 2021, which is associated with the Alpha variant, September 2021, coinciding with the fall school opening and arrival of Delta, and January 2022, associated with the major surge of Omicron. We saw smaller but real increases in cases coinciding with children returning to school after summer and winter breaks in 2021-22 and 2022-23. But I think the study that provided the clearest and most compelling answer to the risk of infection in children related to school attendance and the role that that played in terms of subsequent transmission in the community was an elaborate U.S. cohort study of 166,170 households with adults and children using smart thermometers conducted from October 2019 to October 2022. The authors concluded that more than 70% of household transmission in homes with adults and children were from a pediatric index case. When schools reopened in the fall 2020, children contributed more to household transmission when they were in school and less than during summer and winter breaks. This pattern was consistent for two consecutive years of the study. Well, then how do you measure schools closed or not closed? And I think that's the challenge that we have, is it wasn't about the school closures. It was about which virus was circulating in the community. Well, how do you bring that into your model? None of the models that I've seen so far even attempt to do that. And so what we have to understand is that this is a relationship between the virus and us. Some of the things the virus does, some of the things we do. But at the root cause, we are going to see that it's not just about what we did that make a difference. And even to the extent of looking at how did the cases of COVID present from a standpoint of serious illness over time? If you look at a study that was conducted by the CDC of hospitalized patients just recently published in Clinical Infectious Diseases, they looked at cases that were hospitalized between March 11, 2021 and August 2022 in 21 hospitals in 18 states. They had 9,825 patients they followed. What they did is they compared adult hospitalized during the early COVID variant periods with those hospitalized during the Omicron variant. They found, compared to adults hospitalized during early COVID variant periods, those hospitalized during the Omicron variants were older, had multiple comorbidities, and were more likely to be vaccinated and less likely to experience severe disease and death. Again, that changed throughout the entirety of the pandemic. So how could you factor that in through a measure of lockdown, mask use, what the public policies were? Not saying that they weren't important. They were. But it's not that simple. And oftentimes I say to people, you know what? This is not rocket science. This is a lot more difficult. And I really believe that.
Dr. Osterholm, we always appreciate you stopping by to give us an update on all things COVID. And you're listening to New Beginnings. On the lighter side this week on New Beginnings, a woman in Italy sued her wedding dress designer after the nearly $4,000 garment fell apart at the altar, exposing her bottom to her guest. The 30-year-old bride said her wedding day went down the tubes because of faulty sewing on her dress. Her lawyer says she was left extremely embarrassed because the stitching of that dress came apart, slid down, revealed everything to the entire congregation. Someone on social media found a crash diet from a Vogue body and beauty book from the 1970s. It's called Wine and Eggs and promises you'll lose 5 pounds in 3 days. Breakfast, one egg, hard-boiled, one glass of white wine, dry, preferably Chablis, black coffee, lunch, 2 eggs, hard-boiled is best but poached if necessary, 2 glasses of white wine, black coffee, dinner, 5-ounce steak, grilled with black pepper, lemon juice, remainder of the white wine, 1 bottle allowed per day, and black coffee. Let me know if that works. And what doesn't belong on a burger? Let me know. You can call me at 888-639-9738. And they say, and you know how they are, that drinking coffee after a workout could be the key to building better muscles. Researchers think consuming caffeine after exercise helps your muscles recover faster and can improve an athlete's performance. A team of Australian researchers found that after exercise, caffeine resulted in athletes having 66% higher glycogen levels, the muscle's primary fuel source during exercise. Just for fun this week on New Beginnings. Get the most from AARP, including advice and support to help you care for your loved ones. Fraud prevention with tips and tools to help protect you from scams and fraud, including a free helpline if you've been targeted, a scam tracking map, and watchdog alerts via email through the AARP Fraud Watch Network. If you don't know AARP, you don't know ARP.
More information at AARP.org.
This is a news-oriented broadcast, and all information is educational in nature, is not intended to be legal, securities, tax, or insurance advice. Please consult with the appropriate professional before acting on information heard during the broadcast.
You're listening to New Beginnings.
New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Now's my favorite time of the program when we turn our attention to talk finance with Leibel Sternbach. Leibel is an amazing author. He is the Amazon best-selling author of Living with Financial Anxiety and Authenticity.
So, the real estate market is hot, and you're looking to cash in. Well, don't let Uncle Sam take all your gains. Join us today as we talk about how to sell real estate like a boss. Hey, label boss Sternbach. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm well, and I goof on you from time to time, but today's a serious topic. Before we begin, Let's get a little refresher. We've talked real estate, I think it was 2 or 3 episodes back, but we're back on it today. What's the tax liability when we sell our home? We never got into that last time.
Yeah. So this is actually an interesting one because most people, even advisors, don't seem very familiar with this. So first, right, when you have your home that you live in, and let's qualify that from the tax code perspective, you need to have lived in it for 2 out of the last 5 years. Okay. So 2 out of the last 5 years, you were living in it. It was your primary residence. When you go to sell that, you're going to owe capital gains. Okay. So you bought it at, let's say, $100,000. You sell it at $200,000. Your capital gains is $200,000 minus what you bought it. So $100,000. Now you're going to owe that in taxes, right? Now, this is again where the tax code becomes so important and we want to do behaviors that are incentivized by the tax code. The tax code gives an exclusion and says that there's a certain amount of money that you don't have to acknowledge as income on your taxes if you sell your primary residence that you've lived in for the last 2 out of 5 years. If you're single, it's $250,000. If you're married, that's $500,000. You each get your own amount, right? So when you think about your house, right, one of the things that I'm constantly thinking about is how much has it appreciated and how much am I going to pay on taxes when I sell it? Because when I go to sell my house, right, because one day I'm going to want to move out, even if this is my forever home, right, I'm going to want to downsize at some point, we're going to have to pay taxes on that. And there's that $500,000 of exclusion, which sounds like a lot of money, but, you know, 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road, you know, that can not be that significant of amount of money. So anyways, we have that capital gains that we're paying on taxes. The important thing I think to consider is that it's based on your cost basis in the house. So typically that's how much you bought the house for. But if you're diligent and you track how much you've invested into your home over time, doing things that are considered capital improvements. So you add an addition to your house, you renovate, you replace your floors, you know, you replace boilers, you replace things that aren't typical wear and tear in a house, you can add that to your cost basis so that it increases or decreases the technical profit that you're making on your home. Does that answer your question?
It does. And that's something, again, the education on this is fantastic. And I love that. So that's if you've lived in the house 2 of the last 5 years. What if you haven't, like it was an investment property? What's the differences here?
So an investment property is completely different, right? And an investment property is a business. And a business has profit and it has, you know, income and expenses. It also has something called depreciation, which if your tax preparer has been doing their job properly, the second year you bought that investment property, they started taking depreciation on the property. And so let's say you bought a property for $100,000, they'd be able to depreciate that over the, you know, next 27 years. And depending on where you are, whatever, you may get more upfront and less on the back end, but they're depreciating that. And so when they are depreciating that, that is a loss on your taxes, that's considered an expense. Even though you're not spending money, from the tax code perspective, that's an expense that you can offset your revenue from, that you can offset future revenue from. This is, again, one of the reasons why, right, when we talk about how to reduce taxes, we want to look at the tax code. The tax code is incentivizing people to become landlords, right? They're incentivizing people to purchase real estate as an investment because you get this depreciation. Right. It's one of those benefits that you get that you can use to offset, you know, really all your income. So when we talk about real estate, you have that depreciation. So you have those expenses that you can deduct off of your tax return. Right. And so let's say you have this investment property and you're renting it out for, you know, $1,000 a month. Right. But you have expenses of, you know, $500 a month to maintain that property. Well, you would only have $500 a month of, you know, recognizable income, which then can be offset by your depreciation. So you may actually have on paper, on taxes, from a tax perspective, you may have an investment property that's losing money when in reality, you're actually making money. So when we talk about investment properties and when we talk about selling investment properties as, you know, investment real estate, we need to consider the fact that the IRS is going to make us recapture that depreciation. Right. And so all that money that we got to take off of our tax return, we're going to have to add that back into our tax return and recognize that as gains. And then we're still going to have the capital gains on the property. So if we bought the property for $100,000 and sold it for $200,000, we're going to have $100,000 of capital gains added into it. We're going to have our depreciation recapture. And probably at that point, we're going to have a significant taxable event, right? So this is the IRS or the government harvesting those seeds they planted, right? They gave us an upfront benefit for investing in real estate, building our economy. But the second we take that money out of circulation, right? The second we take our investment back and we want to live off of it, we want it for ourselves. Congress says, well, no, we want our incentive back, right? We want to harvest what we sowed. And they're going to get their money back. So here's what investors typically do so that they don't have to recognize that as income, as capital gains, is they'll go ahead and they'll roll that investment over into another piece of real estate. Right? And it used to be that you can roll it over into anything. Now it has to be real estate to real estate. It's called doing a 1031 exchange. And so that's why people who get into real estate almost never exit real estate. They always remain in there because there's such a huge tax disincentive for getting out, right? They're going to have to pay millions of dollars in capital gains as soon as they exit real estate. So they just roll it over, right? And they roll it over into another property. And here's another incentive that people have is when you roll it over into another property, right? The bank is going to say, well, listen, you have $100,000 or $200,000 from this property. We'll give you a mortgage. Use that as a 10% down payment on another property, right? And all of a sudden that $200,000 becomes $2 million, right? And then you do that a few years later, you flip that again, and you've got your $3 million becomes a $30 million property. And that's how people build true wealth using real estate, is because of these incentives. And then instead of selling it to live off of the money, they borrow against their properties, against the equity in their properties, because everyone's willing to loan money against a property because they can always go and collect on it. And that's how the wealthy stay wealthy without paying taxes, because guess what? You don't pay taxes on debt, right? Because at some point you're going to have to pay the piper.
Right.
Taxes on that. It's just not today.
You know, you explained something that a lot of people have wondered about, me included, about, you know, big time people. I mean, Donald Trump comes to mind, right? Yep. These people that own real estate all over the place, yet they don't seem to have any income.
Yeah.
Right. And that's how it works.
That's how it works.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Have we missed anything that you wanted to cover today? We've got a few minutes left.
I think the one thing that I want to talk about, right, is as an everyday investor, right? And let's talk about retirement specifically. We've sunk all this money into our home, right? And then it comes retirement time, and some of us have to sell our home in order to tap that and turn that into an asset that we're going to live off of. And, you know, the colloquial term is we're going to downsize. So that's one thing, right? The other thing is, you know, sometimes we live in a big home and we just, you know, we need to live somewhere that's more our size. And, you know, whether we need the money or not, when we go to sell that property, we oftentimes are going to have a tax consequence for doing it. So for the everyday person, one of the ways to offset that, you know, tax consequence is doing what we talked about, you know, a few times on the show, is ordinary tax loss harvesting, right? Where we have money in our brokerage account. And instead of, you know, being upset when we have a temporary loss in the market, we harvest that. We can then use those losses that we harvest that are just paper losses. We can use them to offset the very real gains that we have in our property that will show up on our tax return when we sell that property. And so Something that I want you to keep in mind, right, that you need to always be thinking about, is how do I use my situation to my advantage, right? How do I make lemonade out of lemons? Because that is really what the difference is between the wealthy and everyone else. The rich get richer not because they're stepping on other people's shoulders. It's because they figure out how to use every situation they find themselves to their advantage. And you need to just think to yourself, right? How do I use my current situation to my advantage? If I was, you know, if I had a team of lawyers, if I was a savvy person, if I was an asshole, what would I be doing, right, to make my situation better? And it doesn't mean putting other people down. It just means figuring out what are the tools that I have, the levers that I can pull to be able to pull them. And oftentimes, right, we in our everyday life, we don't have exposure to that knowledge. I've been lucky enough that over the last, you know, 15 plus years that I've gotten to work with people who had that knowledge, and I got to learn a lot of that. But if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't know any of these things. And for the average person, for the, you know, everyday life, none of these conversations come up. You're not talking to people who are real estate investors and tell you about all these things in the tax code of how to offset your taxes, right? So what you need to do is go find people who are the experts in your situation who deal with it every single day and figure out and learn from them and say, hey, what do you recommend I do? How would you recommend I go about doing it? And the great thing about social media, right? You're finding me on social media. There's all these kind of experts on social media. And the newer generation, they use TikTok as a search engine because they figured that out, right? The people who have the knowledge, they're sharing their knowledge for free. You just need to go and find it, right? And, you know, whether you use someone like me as a conduit to be able to access that information or you do it yourself, you need to be asking yourself those questions of, how do I make the most of my situation? What are the things that I think are a disadvantage that can actually be turned to an advantage?
Well said. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Label. Join us next time as we talk about the glitch in the matrix. The what? The glitch in the matrix that allows you to use your money while it's still invested. Is this real or just another one of those internet scams?
Libel's website is Yields for You. That's yieldsforyou.com. Yields, the number 4, the letter U.com. I'm Freddie Bell, and more New Beginnings is straight ahead. Thank you so much for listening to New Beginnings, and it happened this week. In 1862, the Medal of Honor was authorized by Congress. In 1912, the film The Loves of Queen Elizabeth premiered in the United States. It was the first foreign-made film to premiere in America. In 1933, a minimum wage of 25 cents an hour was established. In 1954, Sun Records signed Elvis Presley to a recording contract. He was only 19. In 1957, the Surgeon General issued the warning that smoking could be connected to lung cancer. In 1960, the first Etch-a-Sketch went on sale. More than 50 million of the products were sold over the next 25 years. In 1962, the Rolling Stones gave their first performance at the Marquee Club in London. In 1976, remember him, Richard Dawson? He hosted the first Family Feud game on ABC. In 1979, Disco Demolition Night took place at Chicago's Comiskey Park. Fans were asked to bring unwanted disco albums to the stadium for the game between the Chicago Sox and the Detroit Tigers. The fans got out of hand by throwing and later burning the albums. The unruly crowd swarmed onto the field, and the second game of the baseball doubleheader was canceled. And in 1982, the film E.T. the Extraterrestrial passed the $100 million mark for earnings. The film broke box office records by reaching the mark only 31 days after opening. And also in that year, the last of the distinctive-looking checkered taxicabs rolled off the assembly line in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It happened this week, and I'm Freddie Bell.
And now, our supporting partner, AARP in the Twin Cities.
I'm really excited to bring on with me right now the esteemed state director of AARP Minnesota, doing great things in our community and around the state. And Kathy McClear is really exciting because you're sponsoring V-Fest. And I have to tell you that I know a lot about the work that you do at AARP, but this V-Fest escapes me. Can you explain?
Sure. So V stands for vitality. And AARP is really excited to sponsor this half day health and wellness festival. It's going to feature art and games, music, plant-based food, really in the idea all of empowering individuals to make healthier choices and just raise some awareness about health disparities.
It's interesting. So this is coming up in just about a week from now, right?
Yes, Saturday, July 22nd from noon to 5. It will take place at Arts Us, which is over in St. Paul, 1221 Marshall Avenue. And there's going to be a whole host of vendors, food vendors, different resources, including AARP, really just providing that unique opportunity for entertainment as well as information about healthy living.
Speaking of fun and excitement, food, food products, samples, and entertainment, is that right?
Yeah, they're going to have music. They're going to have, again, food samples, cooking tutorials. So once you decide to make those choices for healthier food, how are you going to cook it? You know, different performances, conversations with health experts. So a little bit of everything, right? The medicine goes down a lot better when you make it more fun.
And the event is hosted by Living Naturally Abundant. Can you tell us about this enterprise?
Sure. So this is a group that is really focused on building healthy communities. And we're excited to partner with this group this year and sponsor V-Fest for the first time.
All right. V-Fest is Saturday, July 22nd. That's next week, noon to 5. I'm told the address, as you shared with us, is 1221 Marshall Avenue. That's in St. Paul. A festival, giveaways, food samples, information material, cooking tutorials. I need to go to learn to cook a little bit. Do you have a final thought about V-Fest and giving us a reason why we should go to this no-cost event?
Well, again, it's really just about giving them opportunities and information to make healthier choices and look for ways just to bring some more vitality into their life. AARP will have a tent there. We're also going to do a giveaway. We've got kind of a fun cooler that folks can register to for a chance to win. So we just hope folks will come out, engage with us, and take a look at what V-Fest has to offer. And of course, if folks want more information about this event or other AARP Minnesota events, you can find us at aarp.org/MN.
That's Kathy McClear, and this is New Beginnings. Hi again, everyone. I'm Freddie Bell, and joining me right now is John Schwartz. He is the founder of the Center for Combating Elder Financial Abuse. And I noticed that a 10-year sentence has been handed down for one of, I'll say this differently, for one of your favorite people, John.
Oh, Freddie, absolutely. Hey, thank you very much for having me on today. I greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure. Tell us about Scott Cohn.
Well, Freddie, you and I talked about this before and a little bit of background on him. He masterminded a $300 million Ponzi scheme that targeted retirees and also military pension holders. In that, he placed more than 13,000 military veterans in exploitative loans. And also, he was in his 60s when he conducted this crime. So I call that an elder-on-elder financial attack.
Mm-hmm.
Then finally, he pled guilty on August 18th, 2022, which was less than a year ago, and few people have even heard of this case.
So tell us about the details of this case. Why is this so important, and so why would families listening this morning or today want to know about Scott Cohn?
Hey, thank you very much, Freddie. So I'll tell you that this is one of the more complex and sophisticated schemes that I've ever seen. And I say that because he conducted a two-pronged financial attack. This is what I mean by that. The first prong, he conducted a Ponzi investment scheme or a pyramid investment scheme I think most of your listeners would be familiar with. So he's doing that on one side. On the other side, he's doing something completely different. What he's doing, he's offering a lump sum loan for exchange of military veterans' pensions. And in doing so, he was also offering these incredible interest rates of up to 240%. So this is why I wanted to highlight this case, Freddie. This isn't just a simple predator that thought this up overnight. This is an individual that was very sophisticated, that developed this very complex scheme that's hitting individuals from two different sides. And at the end of the day, I hate to say this, Freddie, but he was very successful at this because he was able to steal more than $300 million, which is incredible financial devastation.
What happens to the old adage that if it seems too good to be true, it is, with 240% potential return?
Now, that's it, Freddie. I mean, that's exactly right. It's too good to be true. That adage has held firm for years. It will continue. This is what I say to individuals. Listen to your gut feeling. If it just doesn't sound right, slow the conversation down, because that's another tactic that these predators will use. They will try to speed up the process to get you signed and locked into these incredible deals, which turns out to be absolutely horrible and fraudulent. But once they get your signature, Freddie, now they have you. So that's what's important about listening to your gut feeling. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. And then slow it down and do not sign anything until you're absolutely sure.
Aside from the obvious difference with Bernie Madoff, how similar or how different is this Scott Cohn case?
That's a great question. So you know, it's very similar to Scott Cohen, to Bernie Madoff, in that it was a Ponzi scheme. But what Bernie Madoff did not do is the second part of it, to where now he's offering these lump sum loans. And that's what differentiates this individual from Bernie Madoff. So in some ways, Scott Cohen was more complex than Bernie Madoff, you know, believe it or not.
Oh, this is so terrible. So you invest your money and then you take a loan and then you pay it back toward him. So he's just taking money out of the left pocket and taking money out of your right pocket as well. But now he has been sentenced to 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. So $300 million were lost, and it was only a 10-year sentence. And again, very few people are aware of this case, even though it happened less than a year ago. So, yeah, that's what Elder Financial Abuse looks like today, Freddie. And I'm glad that you have me on so that we can discuss this and share this with your listeners, because I think it's very important that your listeners understand this.
So final question, is there a redress for the 13,000 military veterans who got caught up in this scheme?
I don't know if there is, Freddie, but typically it's not. There's very, very little chance that you'll recover even a portion of that money. So
wow.
Prevention is key here. If individuals can learn about these schemes, learn more about them, become more aware, and avoid them altogether, that's probably the best policy.
All right. Three steps to protecting ourselves before we say goodbye today, John.
Yeah. First of all, Freddie, conduct an assessment on yourself, because that's exactly what the predators do. That's exactly what Scott Cohen did. So what I would suggest do is conduct an assessment with a trusted and responsible family member, and, you know, having an honest conversation and honest assessment, and rank where you are. And then the second step is identify any of the potential weaknesses that you've identified in those conversations and those assessments. And then finally, Freddie, what I'd recommend is educate yourself. Please visit my website. It's endefa.org. Again, it's endefa.org. And we have 18 cases of convicted predators. And people can take a look at these cases and learn more about how these predators conduct elder financial abuse.
He's combating elder financial abuse. John Schwartz with us this morning on our program. And John, I can't thank you enough for being with us this morning to highlight this particular case and also to give us vital information that our military veterans can use and their families to help protect themselves. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Hey, thank you very much, Freddie.
Thanks for listening to New Beginnings, and today is National Gummy Worm Day, a gelatin candy created by the German company Trolli. Gummy worms are usually green and red, but also come in a variety of flavors such as sour and sweet. These creepy treats are one of the best-selling candies of all time. Gummy worms are inspired by the original gummy candy, Gummy Bears. Other sweet and sour gummy treats include snakes, peaches, and gumdrops, just to name a few. While you can actually snack on gummy worms all on their own, they make great additions to desserts like dirt pudding and casket pie. You can also add them to your ice cream, parfaits, and beverages as you celebrate National Gummy Worm Day. Even though the federal COVID public health emergency has ended, it's important to take steps to protect yourself from the virus. The ending of the public health emergency does not change the availability of COVID-19 vaccines. Vaccines will continue to be provided by the federal government through the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act. It's also anticipated that COVID-19 vaccines will transition to the private market in early fall. You can learn more details about the transitions at the Minnesota Department of Health. As New Beginnings continues, we now take you to the spirituality portion of our program, where we introduce the senior minister of Unity South Twin Cities, the Reverend James Stacy. We now join Reverend Stacy with a program already in progress.
And when he was coming over that horizon, kind of, if you remember the great movie Gone with the Wind, when Leslie was coming home and Scarlett saw him from the porch of the house, far off, and they begin running, and the music becomes dramatic, and they run to each other to embrace. Well, Jesus invented that scene first. The son was coming down the road, and the father saw him way off. The father was filled with love and compassion and joy. The father ran down the road to greet him. He didn't stand there at the front door of the house. He ran as fast as an old man can to greet and welcome his son who had been lost. And then he called his servants and said, bring the best cloak and put it upon him. Bring a fine ring and put it upon his finger. And prepare the fatted calf that we can feast tonight. For my son who was lost has come home. Well, if you remember that story, there's a little backstory to it. That older brother. The older brother refused to go into the party room. He stood outside moping. The father went out to see him and said, son, we're having a feast, a celebration, come in. And he said, no, Dad. I have stayed on your estate my entire life. I have done everything you expected of me. I've worked hard. My brother takes his inheritance, runs off, spends it on loose women, as the phrase says in the Bible, lost it all, and comes home. And what do? You put the best clothes on him. You give him the family ring and crest. And then you slay an animal that there might be a great feast. You've never even given me a little old goat to roast for a party with my friends. And then the father replies, you've always been with me. You've always been loyal. You've always done the very best for me. But remember, all I have is yours. If you would just ask. All I have is yours. If you would just ask. Which apparently, in workaholism, the older brother had never asked the source, his father, for a celebration. I've been there. I've been resentful. Struggled, thinking to myself, that's not fair. But I never asked for help. I never asked for what I desired. How can the prodigious father, the great one, the mighty one, provide for me when I don't even ask? Those of you that have studied Unity many years and our early great teachers like Emily Cady, the Fillmores and others, they always stress the principle, in your relationship with the source of all good, demand must precede the manifestation. The demand must precede the manifestation. No demand, no manifestation of good. We have to ask. The older brother apparently never did. So in this story, Jesus illustrates the Heavenly Father and his greatness by that earthly prodigious Father who threw open his arms, ran down the road, met his son more than halfway, received him, loved him, provided new and greater good for him. Jesus was trying to get that across to people in his day, most of whom were not very wealthy and doubted that Yahweh, the God of their people, would even be mindful of one of them and their request. It was sort of like that older son. Well, God knows I need to eat. God knows I might have some dreams and desires. If he cares for me, maybe someday he might send a little stuff, a few goodies my way. But not asking in faith of the infinite Father, of the prodigious, exceedingly generous Father. Help me. Well, here's a little story of how I experienced this. A little bit comical in its odd detail. My father, like the prodigious father, was embracing, loving, and empowering. One way he expressed that is he would always meet me halfway. Son, you asked the question. I'll help you find the answer. I won't answer it for you. Many a time, I would say, Dad, what does this weird word prodigious mean? And he'd point. He didn't even have to say anything, because in the corner of our living room was one of those dictionary stands with his father's dictionary. It was about that thick. And that meant, I'm not going to tell you. Use your ability. Consult that word source. Find your answer. I wonder what he would have done with that opening statement. What is the question that your life is the answer to?
You just heard a message coming from the Reverend James Stacy, the senior minister of Unity South in the Twin Cities. More information is found at their website at unitysouth.org.
Time now for a bit of inspiration. Here's Freddie with this week's Words to the Wise. Words to the Wise.
This week, I want to remind you about the importance of appreciating the small things in life. It's easy to overlook the small things that bring joy and make a significant difference. For instance, during my daughter's high school year, there was a senior lock-in event, a night of celebration, fun, and safety for the students. It was here that I met Greg, the IT person who played a crucial role in organizing the event. His dedication and professionalism were evident as he developed the website, online forms, and sign-up sheets, ensuring a smooth and successful night for everyone involved. Impressed by his skills, I reached out to Greg for help for my personal website, something I had struggled with for a long time. With his guidance, my website finally reached new heights, and he even assisted in managing my passwords and my email. Little did I know that this encounter would pave the way for something much greater. 2 years later, as I took over the management of a radio station, we faced a daunting challenge. Our website had been hacked, leaving us without an online presence and impacting our reputation in the city. Faced with internal and external pressures, I turned to Greg for assistance. With his expertise and direction, we collaborated on the development of our website, ensuring that it met our specifications and projected professionalism. As time went on, our online presence grew, and we even added a new site supporting our second radio station. Whenever we faced hurdles or needed a fresh perspective, Greg was there, offering his unwavering support and guidance. He became an invaluable asset to our team, enhancing our brand and contributing to our success. Most recently, when I was inducted into the Minnesota Broadcasting Hall of Fame, Greg surprised me with a stunning makeover of my website. His thoughtfulness and attention to detail not only touched my heart, but also showcased his unwavering commitment to my journey. The story of Greg serves as a powerful reminder to cherish the small things and the people who make a difference in our lives. His involvement in the Senior Lock-In event, his support with personal websites, and his instrumental role in revamping our radio station's online presence exemplify the profound impact that one person can have. Let's be grateful for those who lend a helping hand, elevate us to new heights, and remind us to appreciate the small things that often go unnoticed.
Words to the wise.
That's our show, and thanks to our special guests for stopping by and sharing information that we hope can change lives. If you missed any of today's show, you can subscribe to our podcast or just Google Freddie Bell or stop by my website of the same name. Thanks for listening, and remember that each day is a chance for a new beginning. See you next week.